It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. If something can be measured in this economy, it usually is. So we will tell some measurement stories today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, July the 27th. Good as always to have you along. We continue today with what may well turn out to be a week-long theme on the program, what we can learn from what we can measure about this economy. We got durable goods numbers from the Commerce Department today, up 0.8% last month. Durable goods, things made to last 3 years or more. Consumer goods, yes, definitely washing machines, for instance, but also machinery and electronics used in factories. Not, on the face of it, and I grant you, the sexiest economic story you're ever going to hear, but durable goods do actually have quite a story to tell, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Commerce Department says durable goods orders have increased 13 of the past 14 months. These orders come from wholesalers and retailers buying stuff like washing machines to sell consumers. Also, inventories of durable goods waiting to be shipped from factories are up. Timothy Fiore at the Institute for Supply Management says that could help drive down inflation.
So there would be a natural easing of the price growth that we've seen now since since the pandemic started.
Growing inventories should ease any shortages, which drive up prices. There's another part of the durable goods report that measures equipment businesses buy so they can make more stuff to sell, things like electronics and computers. Those orders were up about 0.5% last month. Bank of America economist Joe Song says that may reflect a rise in automation, say at office buildings that used to have security guards.
They'll forego maybe security personnel for kind of kiosks to check in.
But former Fed economist Claudia Sahm says, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Today's report is backward-looking for June. Sahm will scour next month's durable goods report because
if the Delta variant is starting to make the recovery a little wobbly, that's one of the places it's going to show up.
Because if consumers lose confidence, they'll put off big purchases like durable goods. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Measurement number two, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. No surprises, another record in May, up 16.6% over the same month last year, home prices were. That's a lot of equity that homeowners are getting, but equity that is not spread anywhere near evenly across racial and ethnic groups. And that happens in very large part because homes in black and brown neighborhoods have historically been appraised for far less than homes in white neighborhoods. Fannie Mae, the big mortgage company, is trying to change that by changing the way appraisers write their reports, getting rid of phrases like crime-ridden and integrated community in favor of more objective metrics. Marketplace's Matt Levin takes a look at whether that might work.
Heather Prechet is a real estate agent in South L.A. She doesn't have a ton of time to talk because
I'm actually going to an appraisal for one of my listings.
A four-bed, three-bath home in a historically black neighborhood called Chesterfield Square. The buyer offered over $1 million and over asking.
Chesterfield Square is right next door to Leimert Park, which is, it's probably one of the more desirable areas.
Leimert Park is also historically black, but desirable or desirable neighborhood is actually one of the terms Fannie Mae says appraisers should avoid because it can be racially coded for white. Andre Perry is with the Brookings Institution.
Simply not using a term doesn't make the attitudes go away. I think this exercise is really about forcing appraisers to ask why they use these terms.
His research shows that on average, homes in Black neighborhoods are valued at $48,000 less than equivalent homes in white neighborhoods. Perry applauds Fannie Mae for trying to clean up the language, but he's also concerned about who's doing the appraising.
A group of white men, mostly, who essentially set the standards.
Roughly 85% of appraisers are white, according to an industry survey. And then there are the buyers, says Prichet, the South LA real estate agent.
Let me tell you where the racial bias is coming from. It's coming from people who are coming here. And they'll say it in a way like, oh, is this a safe neighborhood?
Safe neighborhood. More code. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's today's indicator. The virus is not yet done with this economy. The Centers for Disease Control updated its mask guidance this afternoon. In areas with high virus transmission, the CDC says everybody, vaccinated or not, should wear a mask in public places indoors. So that's item one. Item two is that the White House said this week it's going to keep its restrictions on international travel to the United States. And that means tourists from China and India, Brazil, and most of Europe aren't coming in as long as the Delta variant keeps on growing. So Marketplace's Caroline Champlin made some calls today about the hit that's meaning to the summer travel season.
In mid-August, a dozen people from the UK were planning to come to San Diego and ride Segways around town.
They canceled it because they can't leave the UK to the United States because of the travel ban.
That's Kenneth Lippman, the president of Another Side Tours. He was sure the restrictions were going to be lifted by then. Now, he's not making any promises. Luckily, though, domestic bookings are more than making up for the missing foreigners. Lippman's been getting a lot of calls.
I don't have availability until 4 o'clock, and at 4 o'clock I have our gas lamp Segway tour available.
International tourists do spend more than domestic travelers, though, says Adam Burke, president of the L.A. Tourism and Convention Board. And while he appreciates the Biden administration's caution, he says holding back the most lucrative travelers is holding back L.A.
It's going to take longer for us to recover from a purely economic standpoint.
Another tour guide named Jasmine Jha runs a sightseeing company called Lala Tours. Normally, half of her customers are foreigners who book a statewide experience.
Besides the Hollywood history, they're also fascinated with the West Coast, California.
But for now, domestic travelers are keeping the lights on.
Enough money, hopefully, enough money to pay the insurance coverage and the licensing fee and marketing materials.
Jha's not making a profit now, but is looking past this summer for the return of international travel. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
I spent a couple of days in New York City last week. I think I've mentioned that. One afternoon, I made my way to the Upper West Side, grabbed an outside table at a coffee and juice place, and sat down for a chat with Sally Krawcheck.
Hi, Sally. How are you? Good to see you.
It's so loud in there.
Well, no, it's better out here, even with the trucks and everything.
Yeah, it's much better.
Please, pull up a chair. Sit down, get comfortable.
Sorry if I'm a couple minutes late.
Oh, not at all.
Sally Krawcheck's better known for her time on Wall Street than she is for where she grabs a cup of coffee. She was a top executive at Citigroup and Bank of America at a time when not a whole lot of women were. Way fewer women, it should be said, than even the few that are there now. In 2014, Krawcheck started a company called Elevest, investing at first and now saving and career coaching for women. We had her on the show not long after Elevest launched, and we figured now, with the pandemic and what that's meant for women and their financial lives, we figured now was a good time to talk again. So first of all, thank you for taking the time. And second of all, we should explain why we're sitting out here on the Upper West Side outside at a juice place instead of in your offices.
Because we no longer have any offices. That's why.
D-
did the pandemic do it for you?
I mean, that was... We, as a startup, Elevest is a startup, and...
Which is kind of amazing still that you're a startup with, you know, a billion something under management, right? You're doing well.
We're doing well. We're not yet profitable. So I think that makes us still a startup.
Okay.
But, no, when, you know, you're going through the pandemic and a lot, your employees are scattering everywhere, as they should.
Yeah.
We thought, why am I going to pay $50,000 for an office when the lease is up? And we can figure it out on the other side.
So look, let's talk about what you're trying to do with this business now, 18 months after it all. Because when we first spoke on Marketplace 4 years ago, Elevest was even more of a startup.
Yep.
And you were trying to lay things out. Now it seems with the way women have fared in this pandemic, which is not really well at all, maybe you're even more mission-driven, if that makes sense.
And more important. So... We have a lot of discussion in this country about the gender pay gap, which is important. What we don't talk often enough about is the more important gender wealth gap. So if pay is what you bring in, wealth is what you have and keep. Before the pandemic, 32 cents to a white man's dollar, 1 penny for black women. It's gone. It was going in the wrong direction already.
Yeah.
It went further in the wrong direction during the pandemic. And that's what Elevest is squarely focused on. How can we close the gender wealth gap?
And it's worse now. So the question is, how much ground do you think women lost in the past 18 months? They lost more than 18 months worth of ground, right?
Oh, for sure they did. By some measures, they lost decades of ground. And the comment of the pandemic for me that captured it was by Jessica Calarco, who's a sociologist, who said, what we learned during the pandemic is other countries have safety nets, social safety nets. The U.S. has women. And so they disproportionately lost their jobs. They disproportionately left their jobs because they felt forced to. And they're missing out on promotions.
So what do you do as you're trying to fix this problem that's more than just getting women into mutual funds and buying a couple of stocks here and there?
Yeah. So first of all, money's women's number one source of stress. Taking action around it is the number one driver of her confidence in her future. So this is important stuff even beyond the money. So what you do is you control what you can control. Are they paying off their debt in the right order? Are they getting the advice they need to go for that raise at work?
So I'm going to trust that you'll take this question in the spirit with which it's intended.
Uh-oh.
Well, a lot of the women you're trying to help are going to look at you and say, come on, you're a white lady from the Upper East. Well, Upper West Side,
upper
I guess
West
we are,
side.
Right? Upper West Side. Sorry, I know they're different. New Yorkers are very particular about that.
Yep.
But you're a rich white lady from the Upper West Side. What do you know about my problems?
Well, that's why the team is so important, that we have a team that reflects, as we call her L. And so that we, and by the way, we also do a ton of research in order to determine what we do next, which is why we've ended up out of investing only, because our community said to us, this is what we want. And by the way, it's exactly someone like me who should be using my privilege, that I have had a decades-long career on Wall Street. I know the people who've got the money to fund this. If I were to say, hey, I'm a white woman on the Upper West Side, let me go to the beach, shame on me. I need to use my privilege in order to build this.
So it's been, you know, give or take 5 years since we had you on Marketplace. I guess the question for me now is, if we come to you in another 5 years, where is this company?
Who knows?
All right.
It depends on where she takes. I mean, of course, I hope we are much bigger. But we define our mission as very clear, to get more money in the hands of women.
Is money the only answer?
We do live in a capitalist society.
We do indeed.
And it's not the only answer. But you tell me if you can envision a world in which women are fully equal with men if they are not financially equal with men. Today, there are way too many women stuck in a job they hate because they can't afford to quit, not able to start the business they want because they can't afford to do it. And by the way, there's actually very little relationship abuse, domestic abuse, without financial abuse.
Really, what you're saying is that on almost every level, capitalism doesn't work for women, right?
We'd have to think about every level, but it doesn't work for women. Yeah. And we've also been internalized so many of the messages of capitalism, which is that the money belongs to the men. Now, what? Come on, Sally, that's not true. Do you know that today 90% of articles for women on money are about saving and are negative? And 72% of articles for men on money are about investing and growing. And so she receives these messages her whole life. That gaslight her. Forget about the gender pay gap over there. You just should not be buying that latte. You should invest that money. Instead, that facial is frivolous. You know, we just internalize it.
Sally Krawcheck, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
We need a bartender, and you have the right name, so let's go.
I mean, okay, but honestly, I'm a beer guy. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 85 points today, about 0.25%, 35,058. The NASDAQ down 180, 1.2%, 14,660. The S&P 500 gave back 20 points, just shy of about 0.5%, landed at 4,401. Somebody mentioned travel? Well, yes, Caroline Champlin did. So did JetBlue when it did earnings this morning. Executives think business travel is going to bounce back after Labor Day. The airline reported a loss, not as bad as expected. Shares dipped 6 9/10%. American Airlines down 2.8%. United down 1.6%. Bond prices went up. Yield on the 10-year down to 1.23%. Watch the bond market, peeps. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a climate crisis. We know it. The planet knows it. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Some of the answers are obvious. Wind farms and solar instead of coal. But also, some more fundamental things. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has our story about some new technology helping to green the very oldest of problems.
At Annie's Ace Hardware in Washington, D.C., among the potting soil and ceramic planters and lawn care items, there's a relatively new entrant to the fertilizer market. It's called Bloom. It cost about 50 cents a pound, but it took about $450 million worth of tech and investment to get it here. As General Manager Thomas Vidrodi explains, Bloom is a biosolid fertilizer.
I'm just going to say it's code for human poop. Once you get past that, it's great. It's a great fertilizer. I don't know, we joke sometimes it's artisanal, which when you think about it, it's hilarious.
Bloom is made by the local wastewater treatment facility, DC Water's Blue Plains. Chris Piott is director of resource recovery there. Blue Plains has the traditional large tanks filled with brown water being filtered for oils and solids. But like every other treatment facility, there's always sludge left over. And what DC Water does with it is why it's considered one of the largest advanced wastewater treatment centers in the world. It uses a process called thermal hydrolysis to turn what gets flushed down the toilet into bloom.
And it's essentially a big pressure cooker. And that is the key to getting a lot of gas production and a very, very high quality biosolids product coming out of the bottom.
The technology, which can also reduce the volume of waste by two-thirds, comes from a Norwegian company called Cambi, CEO Eric Fodnes.
So you get up to 40% more biogas. That biogas can be used to generate electricity to be used elsewhere in the wastewater treatment plant or put on the grid and sold.
In D.C., that biogas generates about 8 megawatts of energy, more than enough to run the Cambi process. D.C. Water paid for its project with $450 million in municipal bonds to be paid back over about 15 years.
But because we're making a little bit more money on selling Bloom and we're selling the renewable energy credits for more than we thought we could, that simple payback period is a little bit shorter than it was.
DC Water also saves $10 to $15 million a year because it doesn't have to pay to truck that waste away. That kind of testimonial is great for Cambi, which now has its tech in 4 facilities in the U.S., with 5 more scheduled to come online soon.
And based on the market research that we have done, we have identified 440 plants that's got a very strong business case financially.
It's taken about a decade for Cambi to make inroads in the lucrative U.S. market. That's partly because solutions like Cambi's tend to only be economical for larger systems, according to Aaron Bonnie Casey, who focuses on municipal water systems at Bluefield Research.
And we do see some consolidation in the industry where smaller wastewater utilities are combining in order to capture some of those efficiencies. But that is a very slow process.
Plus, the Cambi process doesn't remove everything that could be harmful. The Sierra Club recently issued a report on biosolid fertilizers coming from wastewater treatment, advising against using them on food crops. Sonia Lunder is senior toxics advisor for the Sierra Club.
There are loads of industrial chemicals that are put into our homes, are discharged down the drain by heavy industry that also persist in these biosolids.
Like PFAS, found in Teflon. Lunder recognizes alternatives, like sending more waste to landfills, are also not great. So she's focusing her attention on preventing more chemicals from entering the water system in the first place. Piata DC Water says Bloom is safe and exceeds EPA standards. He uses Bloom in his own home garden, and his family eats the fruits and vegetables they grow.
And I am just not willing to throw the baby out with bathwater because I know that we're doing so much good sequestering that carbon in the soil and avoiding the use of inorganic fertilizer, which takes a lot of energy to make.
Bloom is already being used in some high-profile gardens like Mount Vernon, the National Mall, and the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. One of the next targets, the White House kitchen garden. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There was a survey out not too long ago from RAND that said nearly one in four teachers was likely to leave their jobs by the end of the 2020-2021 school year. That is to say, the one that just ended. That's as compared to one in six teachers thinking of leaving before the pandemic. So for those who do want to make a change, the question becomes, what to do next? That's the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Abby Norman. I'm a former teacher and current bartender at the Abby Singer in Atlanta, Georgia. My last year of teaching, I was teaching at a charter school that was designed to be online. So in the fall, things in Georgia were pretty scary and nobody really knew what we would be doing for the rest of the year. So some parents elected to take their kids and put them in the online charter school, which meant that my class sizes exploded. And I was packed out with kids. My largest class was 48 kids in a public speaking class. And I couldn't do it anymore. Financially, quitting in the middle of the year with nothing to fall back on was not an option for me. I needed the health insurance and I needed the pay. And I actually made my husband sit down with me and we calculated to the dollar how much money I would have to make freelance writing, including to cover the difference in health insurance if I went onto his plan. And we just didn't think that I could do it right away. And so he and I agreed that I needed to stick it out until the end of the year. I would buy myself a present every month I made it. When I got to the end of the year, I started interviewing for pastoral positions. I got my master's in divinity and do work half-time at a church right now. And some of the interview processes just took too long or there were too many good candidates. And so when it got to July, I needed a job and I needed a job now. And so I walked into the Abby Singer and said, I haven't done this in a decade, but I promise I can do it. And they said, well, we need a bartender and you have the right name, so let's go. I'm making more money now as a bartender for 20 hours a week than I was as a teacher for 40 hours a week. And I love it. I laugh every day at work. And then at the end of the day, I clock out and I think about my kids and my house and my husband. when I leave the bar, I'm home and I'm off.
Abby Norman, bartender at the Abby Singer in Atlanta, Georgia. Tell us your story, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, more insights from the American Time Use Survey. We talked about it a little bit last week. It's a Census Bureau report on how we spend our time. Anyway, this tidbit on pre versus during pandemic behavior that the New York Times pulled out is what caught my eye today. Childcare obviously took up more of parents' time this past year, what with remote school and all. Here's the actual data. Men spent 16 more minutes caring for children while working last year than they did in 2019. Women, and again, this is while working, women spent 48 minutes more taking care of children last year than they did in 2019. Think about that. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context. Comes to us from UPS, which reported earnings today. The company said shipping volume, packages shipped in other words, fell almost 3% last quarter as we stopped buying so much online. Here's the thing, though. Last quarter is, by definition, a lagging indicator pre-Delta. Think about that. Our digital and on-demand team is Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, and Janet Wynn, among many others. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.